One of the things I enjoy most about interviewing people in the wine industry, and specifically Napa Valley, is family. In fact, the majority of the Napa Valley Vintners Association is made up of family wineries. Cake Bread Cellars is family. From their humble roots, Cake Bread has become one of the best-known brands in Napa and is still owned and operated by family. Bruce Cake Bread was kind enough to give me some time just after harvest this year, which was running late all over the valley due to the strange summer weather. The smile never left Bruce's face while talking about wine, but I guess most anyone can understand that, especially since he spends half the year traveling internationally talking wine. I'm here with Bruce Cake Bread at Cake Bread Cellars in, we're actually in Oakville?
We are in Rutherford.
We're in Rutherford. Okay, yes. That's right. All right, I have to get my bearings. So we're at Rutherford.
Boundary line between Oakville AVA and Rutherford AVA runs right through the middle of our property, but just on the south side there. And so we're in both sides, but we're the boundary line.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that. Yeah. So is more of it on the Rutherford side? Or?
Right. Yeah, we have about 7 acres over on the Oakville side. It's the ditch when you're driving down the highway that you'll see, and that's the boundary line.
It's the ditch. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's as good a boundary line as any, I guess. My first question is, in terms of property, what kind of acreage do you own?
Let's see, when we started out in 1973, we started out with 20 acres of vineyards, right where the winery is today. And then being a family business, we've just keep investing into vineyards as some of our growers want to retire or as new properties come available. Now we have about 460 acres scattered over 12 different ranches. We go from Howl Mountain all the way down to Canaros. And so we've been very, very blessed working with some great growers, and when they decide to get out of growing grapes, we're right there.
So do you ever do vineyard-designated wine at all?
Dancing Bear Ranch is from our Howl Mountain Vineyard, and so we started that back in 2002, and we started out with first crop with that, and we enjoyed the wines, but we put it under what we call a lab label. It's a fancy lab label. You know, usually when you go in the lab, you just see someone written it.
Yeah.
Well, the graphic designer got a hold of it. And so it's like, well, that's a fancy lab label. But now, starting with 2005, we're into the etched bottle because now the vineyard's older. It's 27 acres on about a 200-acre parcel. Very, very rocky, about 1,600 to 1,800 feet. And we grow Cabernet, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc up there.
Nice. And I assume you're using those for blending, or are you bottling?
It all goes into one blend.
Okay.
So, great. Yeah, and so we do that, and then we've always made a small amount of Vine Hill Ranch from Oakville AVA, from the Phillips family. We've been working with them since 1981, and Vine Hill Ranch was one of the vineyards that used to go into the BV Private Reserves. Mm-hmm. And so when Bob Phillips decided to kind of diversify where he's selling his grapes, we were fortunate to hook up with them back in 1981, and we still continue to buy grapes from the Phillips, and now we work with Bruce Phillips, so it's second generation. So it's kind of fun to work, you know, two families working together for a long, long time.
And that brings to the point something we talk about a lot with Life Between the Vines. It says there's so much family here in the valley. It's not, your folks started Cake Bread, right?
Right. Jack and Dolores started it. My father and mother both worked at the garage, which my grandfather started back in 1926. And the garage helped support the winery because my father would drive up, you know, on weekdays and whatever, and help kind of get the winery started and go from there.
I don't mean to interrupt you. Yep. I want to talk about that because I remember reading that once before about the garage. Fill our listeners in on that a bit so they understand.
So the garage is, of course, Cake Bread's garage. And so that started in downtown Oakland. My grandfather started. My father and my grandfather worked together. And I'm the youngest of three brothers. And so all of us worked down in the garage, sweeping the garage out and that kind of thing. And so there's a reason why I'm not the most mechanically minded person. So there's a reason why I'm up here making wine. But then when we started out back in 1973, we started out with just 4 barrels of wine, and we've just kind of grown from there. And then in the middle 80s, 1983, 84, my middle brother Dennis came on board, and he took the reins from the sales and marketing. And so just as my father, Jack, traveled quite a bit in the 80s, Dennis travels, I think, even more to kind of spread the word about our wines out in the marketplace. And so when you're traveling around the country, you'll see Dennis out there kind of beating the drum. And so that's the group that we have for the family. And then we're also blessed with some employees that we've been working together for a long, long time. You take Julianne Lax, who's our winemaker now. She'd been with me 18 years up until 2002 when I got moved up to president and Julianne took over from me for winemaking. So just on the winemaking side, it's been my father, myself, and now Julianne over the 38 years. We have Brian Lee in the cellar, who's been with us 22 years, runs the cellar crew. We have Brian Streeter, who we're going to go join here in a second to taste some of his wares. He's been with us 21, 22 years as well. So we're very, very fortunate to have a core group of people to be able to pass that history down to some of the new employees to say, you know, this is where we started. You know, very, very humble beginnings, and it's just evolved from there. And what I enjoy about working with all these people is they're very, very creative, because we are in a creative kind of business, and so this is what makes it fun.
Well, and you think about 1973, that was just before the dam broke. What a great time for your folks to be part of this whole process here.
You know, it's kind of fun because, you know, the whole family's kind of grown up over the last 38 years to see where, you know, it's just the beginnings of wine. And, you know, it's a very, very small group, and it's kind of evolved from there. You see how food and wine has evolved, and you just see the interest and passion towards wine to what it is today, and we all kind of grew up in it, and so that's what makes it fun. And when you look at people talking about wine, you know, they have some common interests that we can all enjoy. Is one is wine, one is food, and usually the third one is traveling. And so wherever you go in the world, we all have something in common, and so that's the fun thing about the wine industry.
And to go back to the family part, how many family members are actively involved in the winery today, other than yourself?
Yeah, so my brother Dennis does all the sales and marketing and works really hard on that. And then Jack and Dolores and myself. So it's just the four of us. We have an older brother who's always been in the high-tech side of you know, that business, and always in on the finance or business side. And so now he's the CFO at Pandora.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great gig.
He's got a great gig, and he's a big ambassador of the wines, and so this is good. Yeah, so it's exciting, and you know, he gets into, you know, different areas that always gets to introduce our wine. So it is a family affair in that regard.
Well, I'm sure too, in that world where he's at, that name's got to be recognized. I mean, your name is so well known, certainly to wine aficionados, but it's also known to a lot of everyday people who nowadays are learning about fine wine.
Yeah, with a funny name like Cake Bread. So being a family name, it's an old English name, and we found an old recipe for a cake bread. And so it's used to be that they used to make it for the sailors and the sailing ship. And it's like eating a rock. And so it's not very good. And so that's why you don't see it. We don't match our Sauvignon Blanc with a cake bread.
Yeah, with there. A rock would be bad.
Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't go well. So, but that's where the name came from, is it's an old English name.
I'm glad you told me that, because I was actually kind of curious about that. So in terms of the name getting out there, how many cases are you making these days?
So these days now, we went from 1973, 4 barrels of wine. Now we're producing about 175,000 cases, with Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay and Cabernet as our three main varietals still, just as it was in the early days. And then we make different versions or variations off that with the Chardonnay Reserve, or, you know, with our Cabernets, with the, you know, the Dancing Bear Ranch or the Benchlands or the Vine Hill. And so there's variations off there. We make a small amount of Pinot Noir from Canaros, as well as we have a vineyard up in Anderson Valley outside of Boonville for Pinot Noirs, and then a small amount of Syrah and Merlot, and some dry rosé.
Is everything made down here, or is the Pinot done up there?
Everything's done here.
Really?
Yeah.
So you bring it down?
Yeah.
Interesting. So with the size that you've gotten to at this point, that still sort of qualifies as a small winery, if I'm overall.
You know, it's kind of interesting because we have a small winery mentality, because that's we still think we're making 4 barrels of wine. We have that attention to detail and focus. And, you know, the people we're working with, they still think we're making, you know, 4 barrels of wine too in the garage. And so that's kind of that philosophy's permeated through over the 38 years. So,
well, I think part of that comes through when you visit the winery. I'm going to say this for myself coming here, and as you drive up the very small area for parking, which makes it very quaint and nice and gives you the impression of small, there's also the honor fruit vegetable area, which is charming as hell. And I have more than once bought some fruit from there.
Oh, good.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's simple. And it's welcoming. It's part of the hospitality of Napa. I think you've really capped it in something as simple as could be. It's like a kid's Kool-Aid stand without the kid.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's very cool. So in terms of next generation, where do you think Cake Bread's going to end up going? Are your kids or your brother's kids or anybody coming along that's going to be jumping into business?
Sort of philosophy is, just because we have a passion towards wine, everyone needs to find their own way. And so it's just how my grandfather and father had a passion for auto repair. You know, they're very, very good at that, but wasn't our passion. And so, you know, Steve went on to the high-tech business. Both Dennis and I have come into the wine business. And so it's just everyone has to find their own way and find their own passion. Then you'll be successful in life. Grapes grow, wine's always made, but it's always important to be happy. And if you're doing something what you love to do, which we all do, you have the best of both worlds. And so we feel very, very lucky to be able to have that.
That's a great attitude, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. I will say one thing, though. You are an anomaly in terms of wineries of people I've met. There are certainly lawyers, doctors, people from various backgrounds. You are definitely the first people coming from the auto mechanic world to go to. It seems like a natural progression, doesn't it?
We're always fixing something, and usually if something breaks in the cellar, you know, the press breaks down. The tech is way down in, you know, Santa Barbara County. You'll get up here in 3 days, and it's usually either a Saturday night or a Sunday night about 10 o'clock when something breaks right in the middle of harvest and it's got to get fixed. And so that's part of the creativity of winemaking is how you're going to get, you know, that valve fixed and kind of continue on. So that's the fun part of winemaking as well during harvest.
It's a big advantage for you, except for you're not the one fixing it, though, right?
Right. In the old days, used to, because I worked in the cellar for about 12, 15 years. And so I used to do that. Now they say, Bruce, that's okay. We'll fix it.
Exactly. So. Yeah. Well, this brings up an interesting point. Having known as many people as I've met in the wine business, you're not going to work at 10 o'clock in the morning and going home at 3 in the afternoon.
No. And it's to me, you get up and go to work. It's fun. You know, every day might not be woo-hoo happy. You know, if it looks like it's going to rain during harvest, it's kind of the darkest of the times during this. But it's really a fun thing to do. And also, I enjoy working with everyone who's working here. It's a joy to see them every day. So to me, that's the fun part.
What was the old saying? If you do what you're passionate about, you never work a day in your life.
Kind of that way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I certainly understand that. I want to cover one area which I've talked to every winemaker and owner I possibly can about, and that is the whole discussion of corks versus caps. Do you have any thoughts on that, Bruce?
Of course I do. With our wines, we're using corks, and so we're doing trials on our Sauvignon Blanc, because I always think Sauvignon Blanc's like the canary in the mine shaft. You're going to see something happen there first, because it'll age a little bit quicker. With our white wines, just in terms of closures, we're looking to have them age quite gracefully for a long time. So Sauvignon Blancs in that 5 to 7 year range, Chardonnay in that 7 to 10 year range. And so closure is very, very important. So in our tests, what we've seen is when we're tasting, you know, synthetic slugs, screw caps, and corks, it's not one's better than the other, it's just the wines are different. And so something in screw cap would be different than what we've been putting in corks. And so it's not just one-off type of tasting. It's, well, how's it taste the next year, the next year, the next year? And so we're looking at it, how it looks at 5 to 7 years out. And then it's not on just one vintage, but you need to do it on a multiple vintage. So that vintage might have aged quite well. But what about something that maybe is a more difficult year, or even a, you know, warmer year, cooler year? How's those closures look? And so we're not saying no, but we are looking at it because we want to know the answer, because we know the answer with cork on how it's going to age. And so you look at alternative closures. What's the answer before you make that switch? Because you don't want to say, oops, we made a mistake and going out that way. And it's only because we're looking at our white wines on having them age quite gracefully for a long, long period of time. And we think that separates how we look at Sauvignon Blanc. My brother says, you know, it's like, you know, who's looking at 5-year-old Sauvignon Blancs? I think you and maybe, you know, someone else in the whole world is. But I think it's important to be able to have those wines age, because if you look at what the criteria of a great wine should be, one of the criteria should have that potential to age. Whether you decide to drink it, you know, half an hour after you brought it home, or decide to put it in your cellar, that's the wine drinker's choice. But, you know, it has to have that potential to age to be considered a great wine. And so that's what we want to look for.
But currently, right now, you're not putting any caps on anything.
Everything's in cork.
Have you looked at this glass enclosure? I've seen a few people talk about it, and a couple of people are pretty passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. And so our first experiments have just been with those closures. As new ones come aboard, then we'll add that to our flights because we're making cases of this, and so that we're looking at it, so we can look at it, you know, over like 2 years. You know, tasting it two times a year mm-hmm. over that amount of time.
So when you get down to sort of the heart of hearts of it, and especially when you look at finer French wines, that sort of thing, do you ever see the day where some of your Cabernets would have a screw cap or something? And maybe that I'm putting the cart before the horse here for you, but...
It's hard to tell. One is the quality of cork has to stay up and also increase.
I misstated my question. I'm sorry. I was looking at from some of the people who I will admit to being one of them, the romance of uncorking a bottle is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at it from that point of view, do you think there's the point where you're going to say, well, we're getting really, really good cork. This is very fine. It's doing its job. We're not having a lot of, you know, loss, a lot of corkage. But maybe there will be that one day where all of a sudden, you know, screw caps are it.
At this stage, what we know now, we would probably be at the end of making that switch, mm-hmm. especially for red wines, because we know how red wines will age. And so we know the answer. I was like, this one's going to go this way. Where screw caps, it's just not the closure. I think it's also the amount of oxygen you have in the wine. Mm-hmm. And so you might have to look at how you're making your wine just to get it into the bottle. And so I think it's just not like, well, which closure you put it on it. It's you have to kind of back all the way up to fermentation and that whole aging process mm-hmm. and how much oxygen, what kind of SO2 or sulfur dioxide levels you want. And so it's planning, kind of reverse engineering all the way back. And so if you start changing those things, again, how's your wine going to age? Mm-hmm. So it's not saying never, but just saying we want to know the answer before, because we don't want to test on our customers because we don't think that's fair.
So when you and I first met, which was at the barrel auction this year, which mm-hmm. was such a great pleasure, so much fun chatting with you, you're telling me about this amount of travel that you do, in fact, that your business card flips over to...
Hindi, Japanese, yeah. Chinese, and so it's quite exciting. Dennis is responsible for all North America, all the Americas, and so he has that, and so my route's the international route, and so go through Asia, India, Dubai... the UK. I'm actually going off to London and Scotland next week. Excellent. So that's good. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about, passions and, you know, wine and food and travel. And so, you know, I love to travel. Sounds odd, but I love traveling, love meeting new people and having those same kind of common passions too. And so I don't look at it as a burden. I look at it as great opportunity to meet new people.
I'm kind of curious about these other markets, especially a market like India.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, there has to be a good reason for you to go there because you want to get something out of that visit. So are you selling a fair amount of wine to a place like India?
You know, we're still, I'm not paying for my airline ticket yet, you know. Right. So, but what's interesting about India, and this relates back to my father and I on our first sales trip outside of Northern California, we went to Austin, Texas. And this is back in 1978. And we were doing a PBS charity tasting in a giant shopping mall. And this is on a Sunday afternoon. You needed to get a special permit, and, you know, and people were walking through the shopping mall, and there were a group of wineries there. And we were pouring Chardonnay and Cabernet, both in dark green bottles. And at the time, people were having a hard time trying to pronounce Chardonnay if you've never seen the word before, or Cabernet Sauvignon. And so they'd come up and just feel the bottles and say, I have a little bit of cold one, please. So you pour him a little bit of Chardonnay and say, no, just a little bit from the top. You pour him a little bit more. But it was from that experience, because when we flew home that Sunday night, it was just like, you know, Tex-Mex food and Lone Star beer, kind of that's what the food and drink was in the Austin market at the time. Now you go to Austin, you know, it's a big music scene, big food scene, you know, wine's doing well, you know, kind of throughout Texas, it's really boomed in that regard. And so you always look at different markets, and you can say the Indian market, it would be one that's like, well, you know, there's potential there, but just have to introduce ourselves. And when you start there, you need to start out with California and Napa Valley, what makes Napa, and then how we fit into the Napa Valley. And so, for example, I've been going there 6 years now. And when I first started going there, you know, always saying, well, how do our wines match up with the local food? And so Indian food can be very spicy, very, very nice, but very, very spicy and difficult. Last time we were doing a very, very nice wine dinner at the Taj Hotel in Delhi. And so they had two different wines, our Merlot and our Cabernet. And so they had kind of a sauce down below, some rice, and very, very spicy, and then the lamb on top. So when they set it down and they set the wine down, poured at the same time, the server said, the Cabernet goes with the lamb and the Merlot goes with kind of below it. And so you just see that level of interest and that level of detail in wine and food pairing in India tells me they're on the right track. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of potential. You know, there's a lot of different rules and tariffs to kind of work your way through. But there is a lot of interest in there in wine. It's albeit in the high-priced wine, very, very small, but still there's a potential. India also has a wine industry, vineyards and wine, and so you see that grow, and so there's interest in their own products, and that, to me, just improves the category of wine in general.
When you were there, did you visit the vineyards or the wineries?
In my first time through outside of Bangalore, there's Grover Vineyards owned by Capel Grover, and so we went out and visited them. The interesting part that's something I've never seen is that the grapevines don't go dormant there. It's because they don't have that cold time frame. And so during the monsoon season, the rainy season, they just let it grow. And then when the dry season comes, then they cut it back and grow it for wine grapes. And so they're doing a really nice job and being very, very creative and working with what they have. And so it's fun to see those wines evolve each time we go back, because they're always proud to pour them when you're there.
Oh, I bet they're proud. Well, and that would be typical of any wine grower, I guess.
We're the same way.
Right. You're working with what you have. Uh-huh. And of course, you're lucky that you're working here in Napa. But I understand this idea of letting them overgrow and then starting again. Do they do anything with those grapes, or they just literally throw them away?
I think there's some wineries are doing it for very, very low kind of entry price wines, sure. And some aren't. So it's kind of depends on where they are. And so I think there's a lot of different producers out there, and I think some are using it, but it's for the lower price wines.
So it's a classic example of what's happening in the United States. Now that wine has officially started to outsell beer, they're starting to grow into, what's this whole wine thing all about? And yet, it's still a country that's so incredibly old.
Right.
That's sort of fascinating when you think about how old wine is, that it's almost like they're discovering it now.
It's really exciting. And so to see that and how it matches in with, you know, their food, their wine, and how they serve it. So it's exciting, you know, and you can look at a lot of different regions around the world to see that evolve and grow. And I think just also with all the, you know, other producers from other wine growing regions traveling to all these markets, the amount of education, it's growing faster than it did back in the 70s.
Do you compete against Europe then?
Yes, you know what? This is what makes it fun is, you know, all wine growing regions, when you're into some of these markets, everyone's on a level playing field, because mm-hmm. we're all traveling, you know, a long, long ways to get there. And so it does make a level playing field.
It's got to be interesting to be in a place like India pouring a bottle of California wine. That just would blow my mind.
You get into, you know, different situations, but you also get, what's really fun is you meet someone over there, and then when they come to Napa, you know, because you can talk to them, show all the, you know, the slides and everything. When they get here, they kind of go, oh, wow.
So you have brought them here. They have come here.
Yes, we just had the Oberoi group come out with a group of managers the end of September and came out and be able to show them what we're doing. And a lot of these guys, you know, are traveling through. And so it's really fun to receive guests when they come out to Napa to be able to show off, just like they're very proud of India. We're very, very proud of Napa Valley to be able to show off what we have here. And so it's exciting.
I'll bet. That would be a blast to host them, just to show them this totally different experience.
Down in Napa, there's a vegetarian restaurant, very, very nice, Ubuntu. Mm-hmm. And so we had some Indian guests. And so, you know, they're veg. And so we took them down there and show them, well, this is Napa Valley's version of veg. And mm-hmm. it's like, wow, this is pretty neat. And so it was really an exciting dinner to watch them kind of interact, because it was also a different meal. And so it's just a fun meal, kind of all of us exploring that.
Did they like it? I mean, was that something that was acceptable to them?
Well, walking in, it was like, but then walking out, it's like, oh my God, that was an experience of a lifetime.
That's
in
great.
In terms of looking at it that way.
I love watching you talk about it. Your face lights up when you talk about it. I want to talk a little bit about China, because China's mm-hmm. obviously growing, Asia in general is growing into a big wine drinking area, and they're certainly learning about fine wines too, mm-hmm. and they're learning fast. What's been your experience?
Throughout Asia, Japan's always been our strongest or number one, because my father's been going to Japan for 20, 25 plus years. Wow. And so we have a good following there, and Japanese trade and customers come to Napa Valley. And so there's always been that nice relationship with Japan and those customers there. Then we're seeing Hong Kong evolve and grow you know, as the tariffs have dropped from 70% to 40% to zero, you just see that expanding. And so that's exciting to see. And then Singapore kind of being the, I always look at it as the crossroads of the world sometimes. You see the different cuisines in that region to be able to show that off. And then Korea is really growing. They have Master Somia up there. I forget her name right now. But so that's growing. And I think you have all that whole area being really exciting in terms of being introduced to wine, fine wine from around the world. And so Napa Valley, we have to be able to be right in there as well as China and each of the different countries. And Napa Valley is just at the beginnings of where we are, even though I've been going there 6 years, you know, a lot of wineries have been going there for a long time. We're still just making a little dent. But the beauty of Napa Valley is, you know, 95% of the wineries, the 400 wineries and the vintners are family owned or, you know. Mm-hmm. And so with family business, doesn't matter if they're in the wine or whatever, everyone, family business always look for the long term. And so you take that and you add that to how we're going to get our wines into new countries. Take the long term. We don't need to, you know, be a rock star overnight.
Sure.
But over time, we will be there and we'll, you know, being consistently being in those markets. So I have great hope for all of Napa Valley being able to do better than what we have in the past in terms of all those Asian markets, just not China, but all of them.
3 years ago when I started doing this project, one of the big questions was worrying about families going away and more corporations coming in the valley. But I'm seeing so many more small mom-pa type people opening up tasting rooms and selling wine however they can sell it. Would you agree that the family is almost coming back stronger right now?
Well, you see a lot of passionate people starting out. And so again, out of the Napa Valley vintners, 74% of us make less than 10,000 cases. And so we bond with them because that's how we started out. Mm-hmm. We're the guy who started out with four barrels of wine. And so we think, you know, we're all in it together. Also, the large wineries also can do things that the small wineries can't. And so to have that nice mix and balance, I think which is the strength of Napa Valley.
I agree. I agree tremendously on that. So just one more trip into China here for a moment.
Uh-huh.
Considering your success in Japan, your dad's success when he started off, do you think you'll have that China, based on its size and how fast it's growing in knowledge of the outside world, do you think that market's going to be a more major market for you as time goes on?
Japan and China are very, very different in how they treat wines and their customers and what they're looking for. China, certain things have to fall right for us. And so not just for our own business, but for Napa Valley. And the only way that's going to do it is as all Napa Valley vintners kind of get behind that and make sure that it supports getting Napa Valley wines in. Because we can have success, but if you look on a wine list and you only see under California wines, Cake Bread Cellars, or, you know, maybe Opus, or, you know, whoever, that's one thing. But if we can see a page or two pages of Napa Valley wines from Sauvignon Blancs to Chardonnays to Cabernets, then we know we have success.
Is that cultural or is that legalities?
I think it's education on our part to explain this is why Napa Valley is different from Bordeaux, Burgundy, Australia, South America, you know, to be able to differentiate yourselves. And this is why you should have this many wines on your shelf or this many wines from Napa Valley on your wine list because your customers want them. To do that, we have to be able to reach out to the customers. To do that, we need to reach out to the trade and media to be able to say, hey, look at this. This is a unique wine from Napa Valley. And when they come to the U.S., you know, they usually come through San Francisco to not only go to, you know, Yosemite, Lake Tahoe, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, but also to Napa Valley.
Do you see any other market as an up-and-comer?
Let's see. I think in Northern Europe, there's another opportunity there. I don't know why, but I just think that, you know, you have people familiar with wine, you have the world getting smaller, people are traveling more. I think there's just another opportunity to kind of relook at all of Europe there. Maybe not in Spain, Italy, and France, but, you know, in that northern part in Switzerland, Austria, Germany, Belgium, you know, you can kind of keep going on. I think there's something there. Is it going to be huge because it's a little bit more difficult for us to compete you know, because, you know, Italy's closer and, you know, that's playing in their backyard. Mm-hmm. When they come here, they're playing in our backyard. And so it's, can we get back over there?
That was a great answer and completely unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
I did not even think you were going to go there.
Well, I think looking at Napa Valley as a whole, I think it's an exciting time. We just did a tasting to show off how 2010 vintage fits into Napa Valley, all the other previous vintages. And so we did an incredible tasting of 2001 to 2010, tank sample 2010, of Opus, Farniente, Kathy Corison, and our Dancing Bear Ranch.
Hmm.
And so we're looking at, and it's not a beauty contest, but we're looking at trends of the vintages and then trying to relate how that fits in there. During conversation, we were talking that I think this decade is one of the greatest times to be growing grapes in a whole 150 years. And it's like, whoa, that's kind of a big statement. But if you look at it, as we've gone through AXR vineyard planting, everything was planted, you know, 12 feet rows, these giant sprawling vines and whatever. And then we had to go through phylloxera back in the late 80s, early 90s. So we had vineyards going down because of phylloxera and young vineyards coming up in the 90s. Now all these vineyards that have been replanted because of phylloxera are all starting to hit their, you know, 15-year-old, 20-year-old age range. These vineyards are starting to produce some, you know, having some vine age onto it and producing some, I think, fantastic wines. And so that's why if you look at over 150 years, this is the decade that's special. And it's, I think, learning what we've learned as a whole, I think we're able to leverage that even more because people are talking more. And I think they're leveraging also on how the early producers all talk to each other and shared information. All, you know, if Napa Valley is doing well, everyone's doing well. And that philosophy and that foundation, I think the vintners of today and the grape growers today are building upon that. I think we have a strong foundation of what was given to us, like Louis Martini, Jack Davies, Robert Madai. You could go, the list goes on. And so we have this gift to us in the valley. And what I see is that we're taking advantage of that and being able to do something that's even better and being able to kind of hit that vision of what the early guys thought about when they started the Ag Preserve back in 1968. This is a special ground. We don't want to pave it over. We want to keep it in vineyards. We see today, you know, 40 years later, it's still working. So to me, that's the exciting thing is we're in for an exciting time just in terms of the wines coming out of Napa Valley.
I love how during the course of this conversation, you've gone forward and you've gone backward. And I think that shows a great deal of respect. I'm very impressed by that. So
great.
Where can our listeners find your wines?
Let's see, we're sold, you know, in fine wine shops and then also in fine restaurants across the country. And so if they don't have it, ask them for it. Just like my grandmother used to walk into a restaurant, if didn't see cake bread in there, it's like, hey, where is that cake bread? So they always saw that white-haired lady come in. It's like, oh, no, not her again. So, if they don't have it, usually you can just ask them for it. So.
And you have a wine club online?
Of course. And also online, you can get on our website or call the winery, you know, it's cakebread.com. And just be able to call us and we'd be able to help you in that needs. But also look for your local wine shop right around the corner, too.
That's terrific. Bruce, this has been a lot of fun and incredibly educational. Thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Find Cake Bread Wine on the web at cakebread.com.